touch-up work on the fighter, including resizing his ears, a comprehensive dye job on his hair, head 2 feet, tonal changes to his vocal cords, and some bone smoothing on his brow and chin. They were all small operations, but the total effect was that El Mujahid looked even more like a European. Like a Brit. Give him a modern haircut, lose the fierce mustache, and put him in an Armani suit, Galt considered, and he could pass for Northern Italian or even Welsh. The anomaly of the fighter's complexion, and his ability to speak an uninflected English with a hint of a British accent, factored heavily in Galt's plans for the man. And Galt had paid good money to make sure that under the right circumstances, the fighter would make a believable non-Arab. He'd even provided a series of audio tapes to allow the fighter to practice speaking with an American accent. Galt looked at his watch, a Tourneau Presidio Arabesque 36 that he'd taken from a former colleague who had no further need for checking the time of day.
As always, my friend, you are precise to the minute.
The Koran says that, but that was all Galt heard. El Mujahid loved his long-winded scripture quotations, and as soon as the big man was in gear, Galt tuned him out. He sometimes forced himself to mentally say yada 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 to drown out the doctrine. That worked well, and he had himself trained to start paying attention again when the fighter wrapped it up with his trademark closer, Allah is the only God, and I am his wrath on earth. Grandiose, but catchy. Galt liked the wrath part. Wrath was useful.
Very apt, he said of the unheard scripture. Your men should be praised for their devotion to the cause and to the will of Allah.
Galt was a lapsed Presbyterian, not completely atheist. He believed some kind of God existed somewhere, he just didn't think the human race had the divine all on speed dial. And whatever calls they did make were certainly not being returned. To Galt, religion was something to be factored into any equation. Only a fool dismissed its power or ignored its useful potential,
and only a suicidal fool allowed even a hint of disingenuousness to flavor his words.
Financial backer or not, Galt would find himself lying in parts all over this corner of Afghanistan if El Mujahid thought that he was mocking his faith. The fighter's swagger might have started as affect, but his faith had never been anything but absolute. The fighter nodded his thanks for the comment.
"Will you stay for dinner?" Galt asked. "I had some chickens flown in with me, and fresh vegetables."
"No," the fighter said, shaking his head with obvious regret. "I'm crossing over into Iraq tomorrow. One of my lieutenants has stolen a British half-track. I will oversee the placement of anti-personnel mines, and then we need to put it somewhere that the British or Americans can find it. We'll stage it well. The front end will have been damaged by a landmine, and there will be one or two British wounded in the cab, very badly wounded, unable to speak, but clearly alive. This has worked many times for us. They care more about their wounded than they do about their cause, which should convince even the stupidest of men that they do not have God in their hearts or holy purpose to guide their hands. Galt bowed in acknowledgment of the point, and he admired El Mujahid's tactics, largely because the fighter understood Allied thinking. They always favored rescue over common sense, which made sabotage so effective for men like El Mujahid, and which made profit so deliciously easy for Galt. Since long before the American body count had hit quadruple digits, three of Galt's subsidiary companies had landed contracts for improved plastics and alloys, both for wheeled vehicles and human assets. Now half the soldiers in the field wore anti-shrapnel polymer undershirts and shorts. Quite a few lives had even been saved, not that this mattered in anything except price negotiations during contract meetings, but it was there. So, the more damage El Mujahid could do with his clever booby traps, the more defensive products would be purchased, And even though plastics, petrochemicals, and alloys were only 11% of his business, it still brought in $630 million per year, so it was all a win-win situation.
"Oh, I understand, my friend," he said, putting authentic-sounding regret into his voice. "You go in safety, and may Allah bless your journey."
He saw the effect the words had on the big man. El Mujahid actually looked touched. How delicious. Amira had long ago coached Galt in what to say when it came to matters of the faith, and Galt was as good a student as he was an actor. After his second meeting with the fighter, and after Galt had privately noticed the subtle signs indicating how thoroughly his luggage was being searched every time he came here, he'd started packing a worn copy of a French edition of Introduction to Islam, Understand the Pathway to the True Faith, a book written by a European who had gone on to become a significant and very outspoken voice in Islamic politics. Galt and Amira spent hours with the book, underlining key passages, making sure important pages were dog-eared, and ensuring that the bookmark was never in the same place twice. El Mujahid had never openly spoken of what he believed to be Galt's process of conversion, but each time they met, the big man was warmer to him, treating him like family now, where once he had kept him at arm's length.
"I'll be finished in time for the next phase of the program," the fighter said. "I hope you have no worries about that." "Not at all. If I can't trust you, who can I trust?" They both smiled at that.
"All of the transportation steps are locked down," Galt added. "You'll be in America by the 2nd of July, the 3rd at the very latest."
"That cuts it close."
Galt shook his head. "The timetable leaves less time for random events to interfere. Trust me on this, my friend, this is something I do very well." El Mujahid considered for a moment, then nodded.
"Well, I have to go. A sword rusts in its sheath, and an unfired arrow becomes brittle with disuse," Galt said, completing the ancient aphorism.
They stood and embraced, and Galt suffered through the big man's enthusiastic hugs and backslapping. The man was a foul-smelling oaf and as strong as a bear. They swapped a few pleasantries, and the fighter strode out of the tent. Galt waited until he heard the growl of El Mujahid's truck. He got up and stood in the tent's opening and watched the fighter and the last of his team disappear in swirls of brown dust and diesel exhaust as they crested a hill and dropped down the other side. Now he could concentrate on his real work. Not plastics or polymers, not body armor for Yanks about whom he didn't give a moment's real thought. No. Now he would meet with Amira and visit her lab to see what his gorgeous little Dr. Frankenstein had on the slab. His satellite phone vibrated in his pocket and he checked the screen display, smiled, and thumbed the button.
"Is everything coded?"
"Of course," said Toys, which is what he always said. Toys would forget to breathe before he'd forget to engage his phone scrambler.
"Good afternoon, Toys."
"Good afternoon, sir.
I hope you are well." "I'm visiting our friends. In fact, your favorite person just left."
"And how is El Musclehead? I'm so sorry to have missed him," Toys said with enough acid to burn through tank armor.
Toys, born Alexander Chismer in Purfleet, never bothered to hide his contempt of El Mujahid. The fighter was gruff, dirty, and politically expansive. Toys was none of those things. Toys was a slim and elegant young man, naturally fastidious, and as far as Galt could tell, absolutely unburdened by any weight of morality. Toys had two loyalties, money and Galt. His love for the former bordered on the erotic, his love for the latter was in no way romantic. Toys was sexually omnivorous, but his tastes ran to expensive fashion models of both sexes, and of the kind once known as heroin chic. Besides, Toys was the ultimate business professional, and he had steel walls between his personal affairs and his responsibilities as Galt's personal assistant. He was also the only person on Earth Galt truly trusted.
He sends his love, Galt said.
Toys gave a wicked laugh.
How are the travel arrangements coming along?
It's all done, sir.
Our sweaty friend will have a wonderful world tour without incident.
Galt grinned. You're a marvel, Toys.
Yes, Toys purred. I am.
And by the way, have you seen her yet?
His voice dripped with cold venom.
She'll be here in a few minutes.
Well, give her a big wet kiss from me.
I'm sure she'll be thrilled to hear that.
Any news, or are you just calling to chit-chat?
Actually, the bloody Yank has been calling day and night.
Galt's smile flickered.
Oh? What's the urgency?
He wouldn't tell me, but I gather it has something to do with our friends abroad.
I'd better call him.
Probably best,
agreed Toys, and then added,
Sir, I'm not entirely confident that the Yank is, how should I put it, a reliable asset?
He's usefully placed.
So is Erectum.
Galt laughed.
Be nice, we need him for now.
Toys said,
You need better friends.
He's not a friend, he's a tool.
Too right he is.
I'll sort him out. In the meantime, get your ass on a plane and meet me in Baghdad.
Where do you think I'm calling you from? Toys asked dryly.
Are you reading my mind now?
Galt said.
I believe that's in my job description.
I believe it is.
Galt smiled as he disconnected the call. He punched in a new number and waited while it rang through.
Department of Homeland Security, said the voice at the other end.
Chapter 8. U.S. Route 50 in Maryland, Saturday, June 27th, 4:25 p.m. The drive back to Baltimore gave me time to think, and the thoughts I had weren't nice ones. I wanted to kick Church's ass for busting a big wet hole in my peace of mind. He had made me fight a dead guy. A dead guy. I think I logged 40 miles of my trip with that thought playing over and over like a skipping record. It's kind of a hard thought to get past. Me. Dead guy. In a room. Dead guy wants a piece of me. Find a comfortable chair for that to sit in. Javad was not alive when he attacked me. I may not be a scientist, but one of those bottom-line factoids everyone, Eastern, Western, alternative health, all of them, will agree on is that dead guys don't try to bite you. In movies, yeah, okay, not in Baltimore. But Javad was dead, so there was that. Another 20 miles blurred by.
What was it Church had said?
Prions. I had to look that up when I got home. What little I knew was Discovery Channel stuff, something related to Mad Cow, maybe? So, okay, Joe. If it's real, then make some sense of it. Mad Cow and dead terrorists. Bioweapons of some kind. With dead guys. DMS, Department of Military Sciences, sister org to Homeland. What kind of math does that make? I put the new White Stripes CD in the deck and tried not to think about it. Worked for nearly 4 seconds. I pulled off the road, went into a Starbucks, ordered a venti and a chocolate chunk cookie. Screw Church, what does he know about cookies? I paid the tab, left my stuff on the counter, went into the bathroom, splashed water on my face, and then threw my guts up in the toilet. I could feel the shakes starting to come back, so I washed my face, rinsed my mouth out with handfuls of tap water, pasted on my best "I didn't just kill a zombie" expression, and left with my coffee. Chapter 9. Sebastian Galt, Helmand Province, Afghanistan, 6 days ago. Into his phone, Sebastian Galt said,
Line.
Clear, the voice responded, indicating that both ends of the call were on active scramble.
I hear you've been trying to call me. What's the crisis this time?
I've been calling you for days. The voice at the other end was male, American with a southern accent. It's about the dockside warehouse.
I figured. Have they hit it yet?
Yes, just like you said they would. Full hit, total loss. The American told Galt about the task force hit. He quoted directly from the official reports filed with Homeland and the NSA. He referred to Homeland as Big G. Galt smiled, but he made his voice sound deeply worried.
Are you sure the entire cell is terminated? All of them?
The task force report said that some were killed during the raid, and the rest died from what they're calling suicide drugs. They've got nobody to question. No one's going to disappear to Guantanamo Bay for any friendly chats.
And the subject? What about him?
KIA at the site.
Killed?
Galt asked, giving the word the kind of dubious inflection it now deserved. It wasn't lost on the American, who hesitated before continuing with his report. One of the Baltimore cops took him down. He was taken to a local hospital as a DOA, and I'm told that he's on ice somewhere. Galt considered this. If the subject was in a morgue storage drawer, then the plan was going off the rails. He had been infected with Generation 3 of the Saif al-Din, the Sword of the Faithful. He should not have been lying idly about. However, Galt seriously doubted that this was the case.
Find out for sure.
I've put a top guy on it and should be able to lock it down soonest.
What about the other two shipments?
They left by truck the day before the place was hit.
Did everything go as planned?
Sure. They successfully tailed the one we wanted and lost the other. It all went fine. Right now they're surveilling the big plant and doing satellite flybys and thermal scans with helos, but no one has gone in because of a general sit-and-wait order.
Issued by whom?
The American cleared his throat.
The Geek Squad.
Geek Squad was their personal code for the DMS.
Perfect.
Glad you think so, said the American, but I think you're playing with goddamn fire here.
Have a little faith,
chided Galt. Faith my ass. How are we going to evacuate the plant? That's my question. The geeks may only be watching now, but a go order can come down any second, and I don't think I can stop them from... Galt cut him off.
I'm not asking you to. Just sit tight and keep your eyes and ears open. I'll be reachable for the next 3 or 4 days. In the meantime, download everything, including the official warehouse assault report to my PDA.
He parted the tent flaps and looked out at the rocks and sand, at the sparse bunch grass and withered scrub date palms. This part of Afghanistan always looked like a wasteland. Then a flash of movement caught his eye, and he saw three people coming toward him from the mouth of a small cave halfway up the valley, a woman with two heavily armed guards flanking her. Amira, coming to take him to the lab. He let out the held breath that had started to burn stale in his chest. "But it's too late to evacuate the staff," the American said.
"Are you that concerned for their well-being?"
the American laughed.
"Yeah, right. I'm thinking of what the Geek Squad could do with what they find in there."
"They'll do exactly what we want them to do."
He meant to say, "what I want them to do," but decided to throw the American a bone.
"Keep me posted. If you can't reach me, then make sure my assistant has regular updates."
The American made a rude noise. There was no love lost between him and toys.
"You sure this bullshit is going to work?"
"Work?"
Galt echoed softly as he watched Amira walk toward him and saw that her step was lively, filled with excitement. He knew what kind of things excited this woman.
"It already has worked."
He closed the phone and put it in his pocket.
Chapter 10. Baltimore, Maryland. Saturday, June 27th, 6:19 p.m.
Dr. Sanchez's office?
Kitty, it's Joe. Rudy free?
Oh, he's gone for the day. I think he went to the gym.
Thanks. I cleared the call, then thumb dialed the number for Gold's on Pratt Street. They got Rudy on the phone.
Joe,
he said. Rudy sounds like Raul Julia from the Adams Family years.
I thought you were in Ocean City, something about a tan, an endless stream of bikinis, and a sixer of Corona. Wasn't that the great master plan?
Plans change. Look, you free?
When?
Now? A slight pause as he shifted gears.
Are you okay?
Not entirely. another shift, this time from concern to caution.
Is this about what happened at the warehouse?
In a way.
Are you feeling depressed or—
Cut the shit, Rudy. This is off the clock. He got that. Since long before Helen's first suicide attempt, Rudy had been my shrink some of the time and my friend all of the time. Now I needed my friend. But I wanted his brain, too. Get dressed and come outside. I'll be there in 5. I met Rudy Sanchez 10 years ago during his residency at Sinai. He'd worked with Helen since the first time she'd been checked in, after the spiders started coming out of the walls. Now we were both dealing with Helen's suicide in different ways. I needed him for my part of it, and he needed me for his. None of Rudy's patients had ever killed themselves before, and he took it pretty hard. There's professional detachment, and then there's basic humanity. Rudy's a great shrink. He was born for the profession, I think. He listens with every molecule of his body, and he has insight. He came out of Gold's wearing electric blue bike shorts and a black tank top, carrying an Under Armour gym bag. "You have a bike?" I asked, looking around.
"No, I drove."
"What's with the shorts?"
"There's a new fitness trainer, Jamaican gal. Tall, gorgeous."
"And?"
"Bike shorts show off my package."
"Jesus Christ!"
"Jealousy is an ugly thing, Joe."
"Get in the fucking car." We drove to Bellevue State Park, bought some bottled water, and walked off into the forest. I hadn't said much of anything in the car, and Rudy let it be, waiting for me to open up, but after we'd been walking for 5 minutes, he cleared his throat.
"This is getting pretty remote for a therapy session, cowboy."
"Not what it is."
"Then what? Does the FBI want you to get your forestry merit badge?"
"Need privacy."
"Your car won't do it?"
"Not sure about that." He smiled.
"You ought to consider seeing a therapist about that paranoia."
I ignored him. The park trail brought us into a small clearing by a brook. I led the way down to the scattering of rocks. For a small brook, it had a nice steady burble. Useful. Not that I really expected long-range mics, but safe is better than careless. "Okay, don't take this the wrong way, Rudy, but I'm going to take off all my clothes. You can turn around. I wouldn't want you to lose confidence in your package." He sat down on a rock and picked up some small stones to toss. I stripped down to the skin and first examined every inch of my boxers, checking the seams and label. Nothing, so I put them back on.
"Thank God," Rudy said.
I shot him the finger and went through the process with the borrowed clothes.
"What are you looking for?"
"Bugs."
"Bugs as in creepy crawlies, or bugs as in I'm being apeshit paranoid, and my psychiatrist friend had better keep the Thorazine handy?"
"That one," I said as I put the sweats on and sat on a rock 5 feet away.
"What's going on, Joe?
That's the thing, Rude?"
"I don't know."
His dark eyes searched my face.
"Okay," he said. "Tell me."
And I did. When I was finished, Rudy sat on his rock and stared for a long time at a praying mantis that was sunning herself on a leaf. The sun was a ruby-red ball behind the distant trees, and the late afternoon heat was giving way to a breezy coolness as twilight began to gather.
"Joe, look me in the eye and tell me that everything you've said is true."
I told him. He watched my pupils, the muscles around my eyes, looking for any shifts in focus, looking for a tell.
"There's no chance this Mr. Church was playing some kind of game on you? There's no chance this Javad was in on it?"
"A few days ago I shot him twice in the back. Today I smashed the guy's face to jelly and then snapped his neck."
"That would be a no, then."
His color was starting to look bad as all of this sank in. "Could a prion do that?"
"Before today, I would have said no unreservedly. And I still don't think so."
"What the hell are prions, anyway? I can't remember what I remember about them."
"Well, there's a lot of mystery attached to them. Prions are small, proteinaceous, infectious particles that
resist inactivation by ordinary procedures that modify nucleic acids. Does that make sense?
Not even a little.
Sadly, it doesn't get much simpler. Prions are cutting-edge science, and we are quite sure that there is more we don't know than we do know. Prion diseases are often called spongiform encephalopathies because of the postmortem appearance of the brain with large vacuoles in the cortex and cerebellum. Makes the brain look like Swiss cheese. The diseases are characterized by loss of motor control, dementia, paralysis, wasting, and eventually death, typically following pneumonia.
Mad cow disease is a type of spongiform encephalopathy.
Coming back from the dead, however, is definitely not a known symptom. So, prions couldn't turn a terrorist into one of these monsters?
I don't see how.
You said Church was only guessing. It's been, what, 5 days since you shot Javad? That's not a lot of time to do that kind of medical research. Church may be completely wrong as to the cause.
Doesn't change the fact that Javad was dead, though.
Dios mío.
Rudy? You do believe me, right?
He stared at the mantis some more.
Yes, cowboy, I believe you. I just don't want to.
I had nothing to say to that.
Chapter 11. Grace Cortland and Mr. Church, Easton, Maryland, 6:22 p.m. Mr. Church sat in the interrogation room and waited. There was a discreet tap on the door, and a woman entered. She was medium height, slender, and had looks that Church had once heard referred to as disturbingly pretty. She wore a tailored gray suit and skirt, low-heeled pumps, and coral blouse. Short dark hair, brown eyes with gold flecks. No rings, no jewelry. She looked like a Hollywood accountant or an executive at one of the snootier ad agencies.
You saw? Church asked.
She closed the door and glanced at the laptop Church had on the table before him, the screen lowered to hide its contents.
Yes, and I'm not happy with losing the walker.
Her voice was low and throaty with a London accent.
I know we have other subjects, but—
Church dismissed that with a little movement of his head. Grace, give me an assessment of his capabilities based on what just happened. She sat.
On the plus side, he's tough, resourceful, and vicious, but we already knew that from the warehouse videos. He's tougher than any of the other candidates.
What's on the minus side?
Sloppy police work. Two lorries left the warehouse the night before his task force raided it. One was tracked, one wasn't. Ledger was involved.
I think that when we acquire all of the records from the task force, things might look different where Ledger's involvement is concerned.
Grace looked dubious.
What else is in the minus column? Church asked.
I don't think he's emotionally stable.
Have you read his psych profile?
Yes.
Then you already knew that.
She pursed her lips.
He's no yes man. He'd be hard to control.
As a team player, sure, but what if he was a team leader? Grace snorted.
He was a sergeant in the army with no combat experience. He was the lowest ranking member of the joint task force. I hardly think—
Grace stopped, sat back in her chair, and cocked an eyebrow.
You like this bloke, don't you?
Liking him is irrelevant, Grace.
You really see him as management material.
Still to be determined.
But you're impressed.
Aren't you? Grace turned and looked at the window to the other room. Two agents in hazmat suits were strapping Javad's corpse to a gurney. She turned back to Church.
What would you have done if he'd been bitten?
Put him in room 12 with the others.
Just like that?
Just like that. She turned away for a moment, not wanting Church to see the contempt and horror in her eyes. Her face reflected the horror, shock, and grief she and so many others in the DMS felt. It had been a dreadful week, the worst of Grace's life.
"Your assessment," he prompted.
I don't know. I think I'd need to see him in a few other situations before I would want to see him wearing officer's rank. After what happened at the hospital, we can't afford to have anything less than first chair when it comes to team leadership. If it was your choice to make, would you invite him into the unit?
She drummed her fingers on the table.
Maybe.
He pushed the plate toward her. Have a cookie. She saw that the plate held Oreos and vanilla wafers. She declined with a polite shake of her head. Church raised the screen of the laptop and turned it so they could both see it. Watch, he said, and pressed the play button. A high-resolution image appeared of a group of men in black combat fatigues moving rapidly through an office hallway.
The warehouse, she asked. I've seen this already.
You haven't seen this part. On the screen, Joe Ledger stepped into shot about 20 yards ahead of the agent whose camera had provided the footage. Ledger spotted two task force officers taking fire from three hostiles who were shooting from a secure position behind a stack of heavy crates. Bullets tore chunks from the paltry cover behind which the agents crouched. Ledger came up on their 7 o'clock, well out of their line of sight. He had his pistol in his hand, but to open fire from that distance would have been suicide. He might get one or two, but the other would turn and chop him up. There was no cover at all between Ledger and the hostiles, but he hugged the wall, running on cat feet, making no noise that could have been heard above the din of the gunfire. When Ledger was 10 feet out, he opened fire. His first shot caught one of the hostiles in the back of the neck, and the impact slammed him into the crates. As the other two turned, Ledger closed to zero distance and fired one more shot, and the second hostile staggered back. But then the slide on Ledger's gun locked open. There was no time to change magazines. The third hostile instantly lunged at him, swinging his rifle barrel to bear. Ledger parried it with his pistol, and then everything turned into a blur. All three hostiles were down. Grace frowned, but declined to comment as the file repeated, in slow motion, leaning forward at the point where the slide locked back on Ledger's gun. The slow-mo even caught the elegance of the ejected brass arching through the air. Ledger had the pistol held out in front of him, so it was obvious that he recognized the predicament of the empty magazine, but he did not visibly react to it. His hands separated, and while he was still in full stride, he used the empty gun to check the swing of the hostile's rifle, while simultaneously jabbing forward with his left hand, fingers folded in half and stiffened, so that the secondary line of knuckles drove into the attacker's windpipe. As this was happening, Joe's left foot changed from a regular running step into a longer lunge, and the tip of his combat boot crunched into the cartilage under the hostile's kneecap. And a fraction of a second later, Ledger's gun hand came up and jabbed the exposed barrel of the pistol into the hostile's left eye socket. The attacker flew backward as if he'd been hit by a shotgun blast. Ledger completed his step and was smoothly reaching to his belt for a fresh magazine when the footage ended.
Bloody hell,
Grace gasped. It came out before she could stop the words. Elapsed time from the slide locking back to completed kill is 0.031 seconds, said Church. Tell me why I want him for the DMS. She hated when he did this to her. It was like being in school, but she kept her annoyance off her face.
He showed absolutely no hesitation. He didn't even flinch when his gun locked open. He simply went into a different form of attack. It's so smooth, like he'd practiced that one set of moves for years.
In light of that video and your assessment, would you consider him a likely candidate for us?
I don't know.
His psych evals read like a horror novel. Past tense. His dissociative behavior was directly related to a specific traumatic event that happened when he was a teenager. His service record since then doesn't show an unstable personality. She shook her head.
That trauma happened during a crucial phase of his life. It informed the rest of his development. It's why he began studying martial arts. It's why he joined the army, and it's why he became a policeman. He keeps looking for ways to channel his rage.
It seems to me that he's found ways to channel it. Very useful ways, Grace. If he was lost in rage, then his pathology would be different. A rageaholic, would have taken up something confrontational. Instead, he's refined his abilities through an art known for its lack of flamboyance.
Which could be interpreted as someone desperate to maintain control.
That's one view. Another is that he's found control, and it saved him. Grace drummed her fingers on the table.
I still don't like those old psych evaluations. I think there's a ticking bomb there.
You should read your own, Grace. The recent ones, Church said mildly, and she shot him a withering look. Tell me, Grace, if he'd been with Bravo or Charlie Teams in St. Michael's, do you think things would have gone differently? Grace's jaw tightened.
That's impossible to say.
No, it isn't. You know why things went south at the hospital, and you saw this tape. My question stands.
I don't know. I think we would need to observe him a lot more.
Okay, he said. Then go and observe him. With that, he got up and left the room. Chapter 12, Baltimore, Maryland, Saturday, June 27th, 6:54 p.m. Rudy got quiet as we walked back to my SUV. I undid the locks, but he lingered outside, touching the door handle.
This Caron Church, what's your take on him?
Car could be bugged, Rude.
Fuck it. Answer the question. Do you think Church is a good guy or a bad guy?
Hard to say. I certainly don't think he's a nice guy.
Given what he has to do, how nice should he be?
Good point, I said. I reached in and keyed the ignition, then turned the radio up loud. If the car was bugged, that might help, though I suspected it no longer mattered.
He's asking you to take a lot on faith. Secret government organizations, zombies. Do you feel that he was trying to trick you in some way?
No, I said. I don't think he was lying about that. Even so,
I can't seem to wrap my head around all this. It's impossible. It doesn't fit. It's all too...
I couldn't put it into words, so I stared at the day around us. Birds sang in the trees. Crickets chirped. Kids laughed on the swings. Rudy followed my gaze.
You find it hard to believe in those things when you can stand here and see this.
I nodded.
I mean, I know it was real because I was there, but...
Even so, I don't want it to be real. He said nothing, and after a moment I hit him with another bomb. Church said he'd read my psych evaluations. Rudy looked like I'd slapped him.
He didn't get them from me.
How do you know? If he's on the same level as Homeland, you could be bugged and monitored out the wazoo.
If I get so much as a whiff of violation,
you'll what? Raise a stink, file a lawsuit? Most people never do. Not since 9/11. Homeland counts on it.
Patriot Act, he said, the way people say hemorrhoids.
Terrorism's a tough thing to fight without elbow room. He gave me an evil glare.
Are you defending an intrusion into civil liberties?
Not as such, but look at it from the law enforcement perspective. Terrorists are fully aware of constitutional protections, and they use that to hide. No, don't give me that look. I'm just saying.
Saying what?
That everyone thinks this is an either-or situation, and it's more complicated than that.
Patient records are sacred, amigo.
He only ever calls me that when he's pissed. Hey, don't jump on me. I'm on your side. But maybe you should consider the other side's point of view.
The other side can kiss my...
Careful, bro. This whole car could be bugged.
Rudy leaned close to the car and said, loudly and distinctly, Mr. Church can kiss my ass.
He repeated it slowly in Spanish.
Besa mi culo.
Fine, fine, but if you get disappeared, don't blame me. He leaned back and gave me a considering look.
I'm going to do three things today. First, I'm going to go over every square inch of my office, and if I find anything out of place, any hint of violation, I'm going to call the police, my lawyer, and my congressman.
Good luck with that. I climbed in and pulled the door shut.
The second thing I'm going to do is see what I can find out about prions. Something that indicates whether they can somehow reactivate the central nervous system. Maybe there have been some studies, some papers.
What's the third thing?
He opened the door. I'm going to go to evening mass and light a candle.
For Helen?
For you, cowboy. And for me. And for the whole damn human race.
He got in and closed the door.
We didn't speak at all on the drive back.
Chapter 13. Galt and Amira, the bunker, 6 days ago.
With El Mujahid and his soldiers gone, that left only 6 people in the camp besides Galt. 4 guards, a servant, and Amira, who was both the wife of El Mujahid and the head of Galt's covert research division here in the Middle East. She was a gorgeous woman and a freakishly brilliant scientist whose insight into disease pathogens bordered on the mystical. While he waited for her, he switched on his PDA and accessed the files the American had sent, most of which were official reports on the task force raid. Most of it had gone exactly as arranged, although the American did not know that. There were a lot of things Galt chose not to share with the nervous Yank. He did wonder, however, why the crab processing plant had not yet been raided. He made a note to ask Toys to look into that.
The tent flaps opened. He turned to see her standing there, and for a moment all thoughts of raids and schemes evaporated from his head. Amira was slim, average height, dressed in the black chadri that showed only her eyes, and she might have gone unnoticed in a bazaar or on a crowded street, unless, of course, any sane man made eye contact with her. Then the anonymity would disintegrate like a sand sculpture in the face of a zephyr. This woman could stop traffic with her eyes. Galt had seen her do it. Conversations always faltered when she entered a room. Men actually walked into walls. It was the strangest of reactions because it was so contrary to Muslim tradition. To catch a woman's eye once is okay, to do so twice was haram. A social and religious gaffe of serious consequence, especially in the traditional circles in which this woman and El Mujahid traveled. And yet, no one, not one man Galt had seen, had ever looked into her eyes and not been affected. It wasn't sex, either, because all a man could see of Amira were her eyes, and in the Middle East, there were millions of women with beautiful eyes. No, this went deeper than sex. Deeper even than religious law, this was power. Real, palpable, earth-shaking power. And it was there, in Amira's eyes, as if her eyes were a window into the heart of a nuclear furnace. The first time Galt had seen her was 2 months before the Americans invaded Iraq. They were 2 among thousands at an anti-coalition rally in Tikrit. He had been there, quietly recruiting and waiting for contact that, his sources had told him, could bring him to El Mujahid. Galt had felt something touch him, almost like hot fingers scraping the skin of the back of his neck, and he'd turned to see this woman standing 15 feet away, staring at him. He'd been at a loss for words for the first time in his life, totally riveted by the impact of those eyes and of the fierce, vast intelligence behind them.
She had walked up to him, affecting the modest gait of a good Muslim woman, and while the crowd was entirely focused on Saddam, who was giving a rousing speech in which he promised to rebuff any U.S. attempt to set foot on Iraqi soil, the woman bent close and said,
"I am Amira. I can take you to paradise."
In any other circumstances, that line would have been cheap. A prostitute's come-on. But to Galt, it was the code phrase he'd been waiting to hear for many weeks. He was so taken aback, so startled, that this was the messenger he'd come to Tikrit to find, that he almost flubbed the countersign. But after 2 or 3 stammering attempts, he managed to say,
"And what will I see there?" She had said 3 magical words that filled Galt with great joy.
Leaning a few inches closer, Amira had whispered,
"Safe Al-Din.
What will I see there? Saif al-Din, the sword of the faithful. That moment flashed through Galt's mind as Amira stepped into the tent. He got to his feet smiling, wanting to take her in his arms, to tear away that ridiculous black rag she wore. He saw his need mirrored in her eyes, and she smiled. All he could see of her smile was the soft crow's feet at the corners of those lustrous brown eyes, and he knew that her smile was as much a promise as it was an acknowledgement. They could do nothing, share nothing, while they were here in El Mujahid's tent. Two guards stood behind her, both giving him hard stares.
"Mr. Galt,"
she said in a docile voice,
"my husband has instructed me to share with you the results of our experiments. Will you please accompany me to the bunker?"
"I need to get going. I have to be in Baghdad by—"
"Please, Mr. Galt. This is my husband's wish."
She put just enough juice in the word wish to make it clear that it meant order. Jolly well done, he thought as he saw the guards behind her stiffen and harden their stares. It was all drama, nicely staged for effect. "Oh, very well," Galt said with an affect of bad grace and stood up with a sigh. Amira backed out of the tent and the two guards took position so that one was between her and Galt and the other between Galt and any chance of flight. El Mujahid was a careful individual and that worked well for Galt, too. He followed Amira to another tent that was set very close to a rock wall. Inside the tent were ornate wall hangings, and a third guard stood with his back to one of these, an AK-47 at port arms, his face as hard as a fist. At a word from Amira, he stepped back and allowed her to push the heavy brocade aside. Behind it was the mouth of a shallow cave. Amira, Galt, and two of the guards entered it, walked 10 feet, and then turned with the cave's natural bend. Around the corner, out of sight of the entrance, was a blank wall of rough, gray-brown rock, hung with desiccated moss. The guards told Galt to turn around and face the mouth of the cave, but Galt knew what was happening behind him. Amira would reach into the moss and pull a slender piece of wire, something that would never be caught in any but the most scrupulous search of the cave, and there were a lot of caves in Afghanistan. She would pull the wire twice, wait 4 seconds, and then pull it 3 more times. At that point, a piece of the uneven wall would fold down to reveal a computer keypad. Amira would then tap in a code, a randomly selected set of numbers and letters that changed daily, and once the code was accepted, she would place her hand on the geography scanner. As far as El Mujahid knew, only 2 people on Earth knew that code, he and his wife, but Galt also knew it. Galt knew everything about the cave, the keypad, and the bunker that lay behind this wall. He had paid for it, and had built dozens of computer trapdoors into the system. He also knew how to destroy that bunker and its contents so that not 1 piece of useful data could be recovered. Granted, a large portion of Afghanistan would be sterilized as well, but those, as the Americans were so fond of saying, were the breaks. All he had to do was enter a code on his laptop, and if that didn't work, Galt always had a backup plan ready.
And if he disappeared, his assistant Toys could initiate one of several retributive plans.
Galt heard the hiss of hydraulics and the guard grunted at him, indicating that he was allowed to turn. The whole back end of the cave had swung out to reveal an airlock as sophisticated as anything NASA had ever used.
"Please,"
Amira said, gesturing that he enter. One of the 2 guards remained in the cave while the other stepped into the airlock with Galt and the princess. The massive door hissed shut, and there was a series of complex sounds as various locks and safeguards engaged. A red light flicked on above the door, and they turned to face the exit door as a green light came on above it. Amira went through another code procedure, but this time the guard did not order Galt to look away. Now the guard grinned at Galt, who gave him a wink.
"How are the kids, Khalid?"
"Very well, sir. Little Mohammed is walking now. He is all over the place."
"Ah, They grow up so fast. Give them a kiss for me.
Thank you, Mr. Galt.
The second door opened and a wash of refrigerated air filled the chamber.
Ready?
Amira asked.
Say, Khalid, why don't you go into the office and watch some videos? Give us a couple of hours.
Happy to, sir.
They stepped out of the airlock and into the bunker that was as different from the camp outside as a diamond was from a lump of coal. There was a big central room packed with state-of-the-art research equipment and intelligence processing hardware, including satellite downlinks, high-speed internet cable hard lines, plasma display screens on nearly every surface, and a dozen computer terminals. Surrounding the central lab were glassed offices, the super-cooled chamber for the bank of Blue Gene L supercomputers, and the five clean rooms with their isolated air and biohazard control systems. Down one corridor was the staff wing, with bedrooms for the 80 technicians and the 20 support staff.
The setup had cost a fortune. 58 million pounds, all routed through convoluted banking threads that would require an army of forensic accountants to follow. Nothing could be tied directly to him or to Gen 2000. It was Galt's belief that this was not only the most sophisticated private research facility in the world, but also the most productive and diverse. Genetics, pharmacology, molecular biology, bacteriology, virology, parasitology, pathology, and over a dozen other related sciences merged into one compact but incredibly productive factory floor that had paid for itself four times over, with patents filed under the names of over 70 doctors who were on his payroll through one university or another. Not the least of which was the first reliable drug for treating the rare blood cancers, new-onset sarcoidosis and asbestos-related diseases that have cropped up in survivors of the World Trade Center collapse. The irony of that made Galt want to laugh out loud, considering he'd advised bin Laden about the likely and potentially useful post-collapse health hazards
before the Al-Qaeda operatives had even enrolled in flight school.
Amira led the way past the rows of technicians, still playing her role as the dutiful wife of the great leader, even though these people were hers, every last one of them. Only Abdul, her husband's lieutenant, and a small squad of his personal guard were currently beyond her control, and they were outside. And even that sense of loyalty would change in time. Everything was going to change.
She led Galt into the conference room, then closed the door and engaged the lock, an action that turned on a red security light outside. The room had no windows, just a big table and a lot of chairs.
Amira turned away from the door, tore away her chadri, and attacked Galt. She was fast, savage, hungry. She pushed him back, forcing him down on the table, tearing at his clothes, biting at each bit of exposed flesh, and he grabbed her and clawed her skirts up over her legs. He knew that she would be naked underneath. They had planned this moment, needed it. He was as ready as she was, and as he used his heels to slide farther onto the table, she climbed over him, swung a leg across his hips, and as he pulled her toward him, she thrust down onto him. It was hot and hard, painful and sloppy, but it was so intense. Their bodies ground into one another. Love was lost in the avalanche of need, buried beneath the immediacy of their hungers. El Mujahid was sometimes as brutal and intense, but he was always quick, and Amira could endure and outlast any man. Almost any man. With Galt it was different. Instead of a gallop to the precipice and then that quick plunge into unsatisfactory disappointment, they raced on and on, their bodies running with sweat, their hearts hammering like primitive drums, their breath burning into each other's mouths. When they came, they both screamed. The conference room was soundproof. He'd make sure of that.
Chapter 14. Baltimore, Maryland. Saturday, June 27th, 7:46 p.m. I dropped Rudy at his office. As he got out of the car, he said,
"Joe, I know how obsessive you can get about things."
"Me? Really?"
"I'm serious." Church is on some creepy level of government, and he told you to leave it alone. I think you should take him at his word.
Yeah, let me get right on that.
What's your alternative? Poke at it with a stick until all the hornets come out of the nest? Think about it. Church didn't approach you through channels. That means he wants this kept off the record. That frightens me, cowboy, and it should frighten you.
I'm too wired to be scared. God, I think I need to get totally shit-faced tonight.
He closed the door and leaned in through the window. Listen to me, Joe. Go easy on the booze. No screwing around. You've experienced two major traumas in only a few days. No matter how much of a macho facade you put on, I know that killing those men at the warehouse had to do you some damage.
They dealt the play. Like that matters.
Just because they were doing something immoral doesn't take away your emotional connection to it. This isn't to say that you were in any way wrong. God knows I hope I would have the physical and moral courage to do what you did in there. You're a white hat, Joe. But that comes with a price tag. You have a heart and a mind, and pretty soon you're going to have to open up those doors and take a close look at what kind of damage is there as a result of this.
I said nothing.
I'm saying this as your friend, as well as your therapist.
I still said nothing.
Don't think I'm kidding, Joe. This isn't something you can shrug off. You're required to have sessions with me about this, and you can't go back on the job until I file my report. As of yet, I don't have anything to file. You've blown off two scheduled sessions so far. You need to talk about it.
I stared out the window for a minute. Okay.
In a softer tone, he added, Look, cowboy, I know how tough you are. But believe me when I tell you that nobody is that tough. A complete separation from your feelings is not proof of manly strength. It's a big, glaring neon warning sign. I know you think you called me today to ask my opinion as a pal and as a medical doctor, but I have to believe that you're reaching out for support for what you've been through. As far as this thing with Javad and Mr. Church goes, well, if you were capable of simply shrugging that off with no traumatic effects, then I would either be afraid of you or afraid for you.
I'm feeling it, I assured him.
Rudy studied my face. I have a 2 o'clock open on Tuesday. I sighed.
Yeah, okay, Tuesday at 2.
He nodded, pleased. Bring Starbucks.
Sure, what do you want?
My usual. Iced half-calf ristretto quad grande, 2-pump raspberry, 2% no whip, light ice with caramel drizzle, 3.5-pump white mocha.
Is any of that actually coffee?
More or less,
and you think I'm damaged.
He stepped back and I drove off. I could see in the rear view that he watched me all the way out of the parking lot. Chapter 15. Baltimore, Maryland. Saturday, June 27th, 7:53 p.m. I headed home, and as soon as I was in the door, I went straight to the bathroom, stripped and stuffed everything, even my boxers, into the trash, and then stood under the hottest spray I could stand and tried to boil the day off my skin. My cat, Cobbler, a marmalade and white tabby, hopped up on the toilet tank and watched me with his big yellow eyes. I knotted a towel around my waist and thought about the beers in the fridge, but even though the adrenaline was out of my bloodstream, the shakes were still right there beneath the surface. I passed on the beer and put a frozen pizza in the oven, and turned on the TV. Normally I'd surf over to one of the horror or SF channels and see who was eating whom, but right now I wanted no part of that. All I needed now was to stumble on a rerun of Dawn of the Dead and I'd probably lose it. So I put on the news. The top story was a follow-up on the fire at St. Michael's Hospital that had occurred the same night as the warehouse raid. Over 200 dead and half the hospital burned to the ground. They were calling it the worst hospital fire in modern U.S. history. More depression I didn't need. So I surfed over to a different news channel and watched a few minutes of the pre-event press hype
over the big 4th of July event in Philly. They were rededicating the Liberty Bell and also installing a brand new one, the Freedom Bell, that had been built according to the specs of the original, something the First Lady and the wife of the Vice President had cooked up as part of their Patriotic American Women organization. Lots of rah-rah stuff to build morale for the